Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Nun Vav Amud Aleph. The Gemara begins 10 lines down, Meitiv Ravina. Ravina has a question. The Gemara here is dealing with our Mishnah first and foremost as to why in the Mishnah, Truat Maser Shel Demai results in a penalty of a Chomesh even though it's only an issue mid Rabbanan. So the question was posed by Rabbi Elazar. Shmuel, Rav Nachman in the name of Shmuel tells us that the answer is that it's authored by Rabbi Meir. It's Rabbi Meir, the Shitato, which is that Asu Chachamim Chizuk the Divrehem Shel Torah. That sometimes they made their position stronger or just like the Torah. And therefore, we're talking about Dinei Derabanan, but they act and look like Dinei Deoraita. We brought a proof to that from the fact that by Get, Rabbi Meir has this opinion that anybody who deviates from the proper structure of a get has the equivalent of no get. And then, if the woman gets married based on that get, divorced another, the second husband, and all the children born from that second marriage are considered to be mamzerim, even though the violation or the problem was only rabbinic in nature. As you see, Rabbi Meir has the shita. We then looked at a case by Meiser Sheni, where it seems to be just the opposite, where it seems to be that Rabbi Meir over there, not only is Mekil in Meiser Sheni Shel Demai Yoter Mishel Vadai, which is obvious, but more importantly, he's more Mekil than the Shita of the Chachamim. And so you see over there that he didn't have the Din Derabonon be equal to the Din Deoraita. Rav Yosef came to the rescue there and said there's a difference between Pidyon, redemption, where Rabbi Meir is Mekil, versus Achilah, where he is Machmir. And we proved that from the last case we brought in the Braita, which is the difference between a Siton and a Balabait. And so we saw here that Lo Yitiru Limkor Demai Ela Lisiton Bilvad, below the Balabait, Ben Pach Ben Kach Tzrich Laser Divi Rabbi Meir. You see over here for Achilah, Rabbi Meir says that if it's Meiser, or Tevel Shel Demai, we do not allow you to sell it, no matter what the quantity is, no matter who the recipient is. We force you to take off Trumot and Masrot Demai, with the exception of the Siton, with the wholesaler. The Chachamim, on the other hand, believe that no matter who you sell it to, as long as you've got it, or you're selling it in wholesale quantities, we don't make you take off Trumot and Masrot. The reason likely being that wholesalers have very thin margins, and if we force them to take off Trumot and Masrot of Demai, then they won't have any margin left. Whereas the retailers who break it down and sell it at a higher margin, they can afford to take off the Trumot and Masrot Misafek. And as Rashi noted over here, the person who's selling as a wholesaler in wholesale quantities, people know that they've purchased it from numerous people, and therefore that there might be problems with this tevuah. There is a safek with regard to this tevuah. But there you see this corroboration of the fact that Rabbi Meir is machmir when it comes to achilah, and only by the issue of pidyon where he is mekil. And that's how we left off. So now we have another question, which is meitiv ravina, lokeach min anachtom. Person who purchases from a baker, maser min achama alatzonenet. You're allowed to take off masrot. Here we're talking about an achtom amma aretz. He's buying it from a baker as an amma aretz, so he has to be mafrish, the trumot and masrot. You're allowed to take it off from the warm or the hot bread, ala tzonenet, on the cold breads. Umine tzonenet, and the cold loaves, ala chama, on the hot loaves. Vafilu mitfusim harbe. And even from multiple different forms, meaning that the shapes of the bread are different, divrei Rabbi Meir. So that's the position of Rabbi Meir. There is Rabbi Yehuda who argues on Rabbi Meir there. It's not brought over here because it's not so relevant to our situation. But what you see here clearly from Rabbi Meir is that he's mekil the gabei, the issue of demai. And by demai, he's allowing it to be mafrish from one item on the other item. Here we're not just talking about an issue of pidyon, not just maaser sheni and pidyon. Here we're talking about achila, the allowances for achila. So bishlama minatzonenet ala chama, well, the reason why we would allow you to take off trumot and masrot from the cold on the hot, kid Rabbi Eloi, that's like Rabbi Eloi. Damar Rabbi Eloi minayin the terem minara aleyafa. If you take off by trumot and masrot from something that is not good quality on something that is good quality. So that you're not allowed to do it, but nevertheless, trumato truma. So there, it goes through and it works, even though you're in violation of improperly being mafrish trumot masrot, because you should be taking off from the same quality or the same type together. So if you have high quality or really good fruits, and then on the other side you have this poor quality stuff, you should separate from them independently. If you go ahead and take off from the bad stuff, even on the good stuff, and you might be incented to do something like that, because then you're only giving away the lower quality stuff and keeping all the high quality stuff for yourself. So if you do that, you're in violation of the lav min haTorah. Nevertheless, trumato truma, shenemar, lo tisu alav chet beharim chemet chelbo mimenu. So that you will not have to carry the burden of the sin when you remove the fats from it, but meaning when you remove the trumot and masrot from it. Im enu kodesh, nisiat chet lama. If it's not holy, I mean, if you're not successful, then why are you carrying the burden of the chet? I mean, that in this instance, and as Rashi notes over here, another Mifarshim note, that you can't just say that the Torah is coming to tell you that this is wrong, because it already told you that. It told you you're not allowed to do this, this is improper. So then the addition of saying, lo tisu alav chet, must be coming to add another dimension over here. What's that dimension? That you are successful at taking off the trumot umasrot, but nevertheless, it is still considered to be a chet, in a violation. Tosfot over here says, how do you know that the nesiot chet that's mentioned in the pasuk is not saying because now that it didn't work, I mean it failed. When you took off from the ra'ah aleyafah, it failed, and now you're eating tevel. That's why you have a nesiot chet, because you're ochlo without hafrasha trumot and masrot. He says, v'eishlamar demash makra d'afrasha greida b'nesiot chet. The pasuk makes it sound like just the separation itself is the problem, not your consuming of the item, but rather just the mere separation causes the problem, and that indicates that you are successful at separating it, but you just have a nesiat chet, you have a violation in that separation. Now that helps us by demai, because by demai, where you have a safek, as long as midoraita, it would have worked, then you can argue that by the case of demai, we allow you to do it, and we're mekil to allow you to do it, because it works on a doraita level. So over here, by Trumot, Masrot, Vadai, if you did Mina Ra'ah Alayafa, did on the bad, on the good, it would work. Even though you shouldn't do it, even though it would be a violation. When it comes to Demai, we're going to allow you that opportunity to use that Kula. We allow you that dispensation to do it, because Midoraita would work. And over here, Misafek, we're not going to stop you from doing it. But even Rabbi Meir, who says that Chachamim Asuch Hizku Lidivrahem Kishel Torah, this is still Kishel Torah, because it works, Kishel Torah. But the problem is, Ella, afilu midvusim harbe, if they can take it off from many different forms or shapes, lichush dilma ati lefrushim mine chiyuv ala patur mine patur ala chiyuv. Over here, you run a much bigger risk, which is the fact that we could assume that the different forms show you that it was purchased from different suppliers. It's purchased from different suppliers. That means the source of the grain here is different. One of them might have taken off Trumot Masrot. One of them might not have taken off Trumot Masrot. In that case, Midoraita, if you did that, it won't work. Because if something is not Tevel, you can't be Mafrish from that grain on something that is Tevel, and vice versa. And there you end up with a serious problem. Either you haven't been Mafrish Trumot Masrot from that which needs it, or you're taking off Trumot Masrot and they aren't Trumot Masrot, and doesn't help you with the other item that you need to remove the Trumot Masrot from. So over there, how can you argue that Rabbi Meir is saying that the din is like the din d'oraita? And a din d'oraita over here, we would never allow you to take off one from the other because of the fact that it looks like you're taking off from the patur ala chiyuv or chiyuv ala patur, because we're uncertain as to who is the source for these items, or it looks like there are multiple sources for these items. So that's the basic question here. Hot and cold, the assumption is that they were from the Yafeh versus the Ra'ah. And the Dvusim, we assume, are from different suppliers or different individuals who he purchased it from. And that creates the difference over here. So now, Tosfot over here questions that, because Rabbi Yehuda has an opinion that differs. And it says, Keach minachtom, maser minachama latzonenet, minatzonenet achama. Vafilu mitfusim harbei, divrei Rabbi Meir, which is what we quoted. Rabbi Yehuda oser. Rabbi Yehuda says it doesn't work. She'ani omer, chitin shalemesh, hayu mishel achad, v'shalayom mishel acher. Because I say that the hot and cold show a differentiation between the sourcing of the wheat, that it came from one person, not another. Akleach min apalter, maser kol tfus utfus, divrei Rabbi Meir. You purchase from a commercial wholesaling baker. Over there, Rabbi Meir demands that you take off from every different shape or type. Rabbi Yehuda Meir, mechad ala kol. You can take one on or the other. You can take from one for all of them. V'hashta kasha, maikamar, bishlo meminatzonenet, Elamid fusim harei amai adrabo. Just the opposite. Minatzonenet achama kasha tfei to make umi Rabbi Yehuda. It's even bigger problem because it's not whether Rabbi Meir vis-a-vis himself is makeo by tzonenet and chama, which is fine, and he's makeo by dvusim harbei, which is not fine. But you see over here that his machloket with Rabbi Yehuda differs according to the baker. It's not about Tfusim Arbe and not Tfusim Arbe, but rather whether he was a Nachtom or he was a Palter, whether he is a retail baker or is he a wholesale baker. And for that reason, there's differences that appear, because otherwise, Rabbi Meir's opinion with regards to Chama and Sonenet is even more problematic. There he's Mekil Yotemi Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda's Machmir over there. We said Rabbi Meir is always going to be the most Machmir opinion because he's going to think it's Doraita. Over here, he's more Mekil than Rabbi Yehuda. So that would be a bigger problem for Rabbi Meir's Shita. So what you have to say is that Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Meir's positions derive from a difference in understanding about what these mean. When he buys from a baker, a retail baker, even if they come from multiple different tfusim, divrei Rabbi Meir. So this difference from Rashi. Rashi separates between the Chaman Sonenet and the Fusim Harbei and says that Rabbi Meir's opinion by Chaman Sonenet is that you're allowed to do it, whereas by the Fusim Harbei you're not allowed to do it. Rabbi Yehuda Oser Bit Sonenet Al Chama Heicha Shem Mit Fusim Harbei. And Rabbi Yehuda argues and says when it's hot and cold, you cannot take it off if they come from multiple different shapes or different types. Shani Omer Shel Emesh Dainu Tzonein Mishel Acher came into Ika Nami Tfus Meshuneh. Because Rabbi Yehuda says you have two things here. You have Chama Tzonenet, plus you have Tfusim Harbei. That's enough of a reason to believe that it came from two different parties. V'hashta Parich Shapir Bishlamat Tzonein V'chama Tfus Echad Kid Rabbi Eloi. That makes sense when you're talking about one type, like Rabbi Eloi, the Shari B'diavad B'vadai. Since b'diavad midoraita it works, I can understand why the chadchila you would say the same thing. But that would be like the shita of Rabbi Yehuda. Ela k'shachama v'tzonenet b'tfusim harbei amai shari. When it comes with multiple shapes, not just hot and cold, then why should it be mutar? Rabbi Yehuda himself is oser, and that makes more sense to be machmir there. And Rabbi Meir is the mekil tfei, because obviously it is a din derabonan, and this goes against what we said in Rabbi Meir's position, and we're going to see in a second Rabbi Meir's opinion, where he is machmir the gabe the palter, and he's asking right now, despite the fact that I know Rabbi Meir is machmir by the palter, over here by the nachtom, I see him being mekil vis-a-vis Rabbi Yehuda, and that's problematic because it shows you that Rabbi Meir's opinion seems to be that there's a kula because it's a din derabonan, and there's a kula which goes against everything we've been saying until now. So Rashi's explanation of the Gemara is that Rabbi Meir's opinion is separated by the case of Nachtom between hot and cold versus multiple shapes. And the Gemara's question is, by hot and cold, I understand why Rabbi Meir would be Mekil, because b'diavad midoraita it works. By Tfusim Harbei, I do not understand why Rabbi Meir would be Mekil, because there's no din doraita that would allow you to b'diavad do such a thing. The way the Balei HaTosafot learn it is that I understand Rabbi Meir's opinion. If you were talking about one type or shape of bread, then hot and cold should not be enough of a difference to be a problem, because b'deoraita, b'deavad, that would work. But if you then on top of that say that they were multiple shapes, then I don't understand why Rabbi Meir's mako, Rabbi Yehuda over there, says it's a sur, because It's seemingly the overwhelming evidence is showing you that he bought it from multiple parties. Like Rabbi Yehuda does. And so what is Rabbi Meir doing over here being Mekil? So that's the question according to the Baal Tosafot, and we explained it according to Rish Rashi as well. So I'm Rabbi, Rabbi Lozer Shapir Kakashule. So now Abaye goes back to the beginning of the Sugya and says, Rabbi Lozer Ben Bedat, who questioned who's the author of our Mishnah, has a fair question, and it's a good question. Ushmuel Vok Shapir Kamishanile. And Shmuel, Rav Nachman Amar Shmuel, answered that its author, Rabbi Meir, did not give a fair answer. That's not a proper answer to the question. The Kashle the Rabbi Lazar, Mita de Bidei Shemaim. Our Mishnah is talking about a case of Mita Bidei Shemaim, because we're talking about Trumat Maser Shel Demai. Trumat Maser, or Truma, is subject to a din of Mita Bidei Shemaim if a Zar eats it. So here you're talking about an issue that revolves around Mita Bidei Shemaim. Umishani Le Shmuel, and Shmuel brings him a proof that we have an author who does such a thing, Rabbi Meir, but he brings it from Mitat Beitin, which is Arayot. We're talking about Eshadish. We're talking about issues that are punishable in court. And he's bringing a proof from that, that Rabbi Meir's opinion is that Asu Chachamim, Chizuk Lidivrehem Kishel Torah, Dilma, Shaini Mitat Beitin, Techamira. It's very simple to answer that there is a difference between Mitat Beitin versus Mita Bidei Shemayim. Mitat Beitin is much more chamur, and therefore that's why Rabbi Meir is machmir over there. But maybe by Mita Bidei Shemayim, Rabbi Meir's opinion is different. Rav Sheshet Lo Shapir Ka Motivlei, and Rav Sheshet, who challenged their Shmuel's answer about Rabbi Meir, his question on the answer is invalid as well. The Kamrei Inhu Mita, both of them, at least, Rabbi Elazar ben Pedat and Shmuel, who are discussing this issue with regards to our Mishnah, are both talking about issues that are mitah. Our Mishnah is mitah bidei shemayim, and get is mitah bidei adam. But Rav Sheshet, moti Rav Sheshet, lav. Rav Sheshet asks from a situation that involves an iser lav, which is meiser sheni. And meiser sheni that's eaten out of outside of Yishalayim is just a violation of a lav doraita dichtib. Lo tuchal echol bisharecha. You're not allowed to eat these items in your gateways, meaning outside of Yerushalayim. So you're in violation of a lav. So how could you question that Rabbi Meir's mekil by Meiser Sheni? Meiser Sheni is only a lav. That's maybe why he's mekil. It's nothing like the mitot that we're speaking about. Well, am I the motive Rav Sheshet? If you accept that Rav Sheshet has a valid question, then Rav Yosef Shapir Kamishani Le. Then Rav Yosef gave him a valid answer. But even though Rav Sheshet's question, according to Abaye, is invalid, nevertheless, if you ask the question already, Rav Yosef gives a fair answer to that question based on the assumption that Rav Sheshet's question is a valid question. So Abaye defends his Rebbe, Rav Yosef, and is giving his answer. It's a good answer, but he thinks that the whole sugya has a mistaken premise in it, that there is even a reason to believe that it is Rabbi Meir. And if you believe it's Rabbi Meir, how can you question it from Meiser Sheni? So, Ella Ravina, ad demotiv minachtom, l'sayle mipalter. And then on top of that, he says, Ravina, who is coming and challenging the whole position here from the Mishnayot of Nachtom of a baker, he should bring a proof from Palter, from a commercial breaker. Ditnan. Halukeach min Palter, someone who buys from these commercial bakers, maser min kol tufus utfus. Over there, Rabbi Meir makes you take off separately, trumot and masrot, demai, from every single different type of shape, separately. Divrei Rabbi Meir, that's the sheet of Rabbi Meir. Over there, Rabbi Yehuda argues on him. Ella, mayit l'chala meimar. So now what you must say is, palter mitrei tlata gavra zobin. That a palter, a commercial baker, buys from multiple sources. Nachtom nami michad gavrahu zobin. On the other hand, a baker buys from a single supplier. And as the Baal Tosafot go on to explain, the machloka between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda and those Mishnayot now becomes really almost a practical machloket. But how do we view a palter versus a nachtom? It's not a question of Mekil and Machmir vis-a-vis Demai, and therefore you can't prove anything about Rabbi Meir's position. The difference in an opinion between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda is, what do we assume about commercial bakers, and what do we assume about retail bakers? Rabbi Meir assumes that retail bakers are buying from one source because they're buying smaller quantities. Therefore, they buy it all from one source. A palter who needs large quantities, he's doing this at a commercial wholesale level, he needs to get multiple suppliers. And therefore, there's going to be a difference in the din. Rabbi Yehuda thinks just the opposite. He says a palter who is buying every single day at high levels or large quantities, he can fix a supplier who knows that he's always going to sell to him, and therefore he's going to only have one supplier. A retail baker who has ups and downs with his inventory and purchases at different levels, he can't lock in a single supplier. He ends up buying from different people, whoever is available that day to supply him the inventory. So that explains now the difference between Rabbi Meir's opinion and Rabbi Yehuda's position with regards to tefusim. Why Rabbi Yehuda is machmir by multiple tefusim of a retail baker, but mekil by the multiple tefusim of a palter, a commercial baker, a wholesale baker. Whereas Rabbi Meir says just the opposite. He is mekil by the nachtom, not because it's demai, but because he believes that he's sourcing it from one person. Whereas by the palter, where he thinks he's sourcing from multiple people, he will be machmir. So again, the question's not a fair question, because if you look at the Mishnayot as a whole, which is if you look at the din by a retail baker and a wholesale baker, you see that Rabbi Meir's opinion is differentiated not because of demai, but because of how he looks at these two different individuals. Rabbi Amar, Shmuel ka shapir ka mishani lei, shem mita ba'olam. So Rabbi disagrees with Abaye. Abaye here just took apart the whole sugya and says that Rabbi Loza's question still stands because we don't have a proper answer to this. And all the people who ask questions along the way, their questions are not valid. So Rabbi comes back and defends it and says, listen, Rabbi Shmuel's answer to Rabbi Elazar is a valid answer because of the fact that it's talking about Mita. Mita in general, whether it's Mita Beitin, Mita Bidei Shamayim, in both those cases you'd expect Rabbi Meir to be Machmir, and therefore it's fair to compare those cases. He might agree with Baye that it's not fair of Rav Sheshet to ask the question from Maisur Sheini, which is only an Iser Lav, or Ravina's question over here is not valid because of the Mishnayot by Palter, which shows that Rabbi Meir's position has nothing to do with Demai, but everything to do with the difference between a Nachtom and a Palter. He might agree with the Baye that those aren't valid questions. But he, the Maskana, thinks that Shmuel's answer, that the author of our Mishnah is Rabbi Meir, is valid. Whereas Rabbi Baye thinks that it's not a valid answer, and Rabbi Lozer ben Padat's question remains according to Abaye. And now the next Mishnah says, Eil Dvarim She'inem Ona'a. These are items that are not subject to Ona'a. Havadim, Hashtarot, Va'akarkot, Va'akdeshot. So we're going to see in the Gemara is going to go through each of these items and explain to us why it's not subject to Ona'a. Ein lahem tashlumei kefil. These items also are not subject to kefil. V'lo tashlumei arba'a v'chamisha. And not in 4 or 5 times. Now the truth is, with arba'a v'chamisha, it's not relevant because arba'a v'chamisha comes from tavach u'machar, which is only relevant by hekdeshot. Is not relevant by Abadim Shtarot V'Karkot. So Rashi notes that the Arba V'Chamisha is coming to the exclusion of Hekdeshot. Tashlumei Kefil applies to all of them, and none of them are subject to Tashlumei Kefil. That we learned in the Gemara in Baba Kama as to what the Mi'utim are surrounding each of these items. Shomer Chinam Eino Nishba. A Shomer Chinam does not take a Shvu'ah on these items. Nosei Sechar Eino Mishalim. And a Shomer Sechar does not pay for these items because they're not included in the Parshiah. When it says, Ki yitein ish re'eyu kesef o kelim lishmor, oh, there we learn from the fact that it is kesef ve'kelim that we're not referring to the items that are mentioned here in the Mishnah, which don't fall into that category, as well as the fact that the word re'eyu would preclude hekdesh from being included over here. So, because of the way that the parshiot are formulated, it excludes all of these items. Rabbi Shimon Omer, Kodashim shehu chayav ba'achariutan, yesh lehem ona'a. Kodashim, where you are responsible to replace them if they're lost or they are stolen, then there's a din of ona'a, because your responsibility to replace them makes it as if there is lay ownership in the item. It's no longer just hekdesh. It's hekdesh with an implication for the owner of this hekdesh. She'enu chaya b'achriyutan. On the other hand, if it is hekdesh, that you have no responsibility if it's lost, stolen, ein lehem ona'a, then it will not have ona'a because then it is hekdesh. As Rashi notes here, the difference being whether it's a neder or a nidava. If it's a neder where the individual himself obligates himself to bring the korban, then even if the korban that he separated is lost, stolen, he has to replace it because the obligation's on the gavra, hare alai. And that neder then makes it that you have a monetary interest in this kodashim. Whereas if you say hare zo, and you make this a nidava, you discharge your obligation once you separate out the animal. If it gets stolen or lost, then you've done what you said you were going to do. There's no obligation on the gavra himself, but that means you also don't have a monetary interest in it, and it's solely a dish. Person who sells a sefer Torah, an animal, or a precious stone, there's no din of ona'ah. You could understand why. The Gemara will discuss this more in detail, but why these items may not be subject to ona'ah, because they are, quote-unquote, priceless in some ways. Now, the question as to whether there isn't ona'ah over here, whether that's bidirectional or only unidirectional, meaning, is there only not ona'ah for the seller if he has the price above the market price? But the buyer, if he underpays the market price, there is ona'ah. Or once we say there's no ona'ah, that's a bidirectional no ona'ah. It doesn't matter if you overpay or underpay, that's subject to machloket rishonim. Amru lo amru et ella et elu. It says the only ones that are exempt from ona'ah are those that we listed earlier in the Mishnah. These additional items that you brought, Rabbi Yehuda, they are subject to ona'ah. Menahane mile. Where do we know this from? How do we know that certain items are exempt from ona'ah? Where do they get this from? The Tanu Rabbanan. V'chitim kiru memkar la mitecha, o kono miyad amitecha. Devar nikneh miyad liyad. Something that is acquired from hand to hand, which means mitaltalim. Yatsu karkaot she'ena mitaltalim. So that automatically precludes karka, which are not classified as mitaltalim. Yatsu abadim shukshu the karkaot. Now, abadim have this, Eved Kenani has the same classification as karka, as based on the pasuk that says, ve'itnacheltem otam libnechem achareichem, that you will pass them down like property to your children. So the Torah gives them a status of karka, and therefore the din of karka will be equally applicable to Eved Kenani because he has the same status as karka. Yatsu shtarot. Shtarot are excluded, dichtiv ki timkru memkar. When you sell an item, shigufo machur begufo kanoi. We're talking about an item which has inherent value. You are selling the inherent value of the item, or you are purchasing the inherent value of the item. Yetzu shtarot shein gufan machur vein gufan kanoi. The exclusion of that is a shtar, where you're not selling the shtar for its inherent value, or buying it for its inherent value. You are only vein omdim elo l'raya shebehem. You're selling them for the information that is contained in them. If you're selling the right to collect a debt, then you're selling the information that is contained within the writing of the get, not the physical paper upon which the debt or the shtar is written. And for that reason, it doesn't have inherent value, and it's not considered to be an item that is traded. Mikan amru, from this you could quote, Amucher shtarotav lebasam. Person who sells his shtarot to a perfume bottler, Yishlehem ona'ah, then there is ona'ah. Because what is the perfume bottler going to do with these shtarot? He's going to use them as corks or plugs for the perfume bottles. So there you're selling the shtarot, not for what's contained in them, but rather for their inherent value. So where it says, pshita, that's pretty straightforward that he's selling them for their utility, not for what's contained within them. No, la fuke mi derav kana. This comes to exclude or preclude the position of Rav Kana. Damar ein ona'ah leprutot. It says that there is no ona'ah by prutot. Kamash malan, yesh ona'ah leprutot. From here you would conclude that there is ona'ah leprutot. Rashi over here gives more definition to this. We saw this in yesterday's daf, as to this machloket, as to whether there is ona'ah by prutot, which was the shita of Levi, that was brought in his braito, versus Rav Kana, who thinks that there is no ona'ah by prutot. The question, and we didn't raise it yesterday because it wasn't clear, here Rashi gives you a little more clarity about it. What is the pruta that we're speaking about? Yesterday Rashi says that the lowest level of ona'ah is an isar, which is the lowest silver coin in the currency stack. But a pruta, which is already a copper coin, is not subject to ona'ah. What he never clarified was, what is the pruta? Is the pruta the definition of the amount of the ona'ah? Or is the pruta the definition of the value of the merchandise? And Rashi never said that. Today, he says, Stam mocher shterot de basam, ein shem hamekach shel isar biyachad ela shel plutot. The mekach itself, the object, the merchandise itself, does not reach to a totality of an isar. It only is made up of prutot. It doesn't reach that minimum threshold. So Rashi here clarifies and says, when we say eino now the prutot, we're speaking about what is the value of the item that you are selling. If the value of the item that you're selling is below an isar, then it's not subject to ona'ah. Basically, it's too minimal. It's not big enough that the ona'ah has significant variation in the pricing, because the sixth of that number is just too small to make a difference or to be meaningful. It's a rounding error. Other Rishonim, and you have every permutation here. Again, they argue on yesterday's Gemara where it was mentioned. I'm bringing it to down today because Rashi here clarifies what his position is. But there are opinions that range across the spectrum, including that whether the ein ona'ah means that there's no ona'ah if the ona'ah itself is a pruta. That could be a way to define it. The others also explain it that ein ona'ah the prutot means that, unlike what Rashi says, that anything below isar, that threshold is considered to be ein ona'ah the prutot, some or many Rishonim take it literally. Ein ona'ah the prutot means pruta. And that means that either the merchandise is worth a pruta, or the ona'ah is worth a pruta. The same argument that we're discussing here with regards to what Rashi says, whether below an isar means the merchandise is below isar or the ona'ah is below isar, so too they argue with regards to exactly a pruta. Not like Rashi suggests that it's anything below the isar, but it means literally a pruta. A pruta, which is the minimum threshold in many areas for dine mamononot, or things that are considered to be significant. So to over here, the same thing is applicable. So ein ona'ah the prutot, again, does it refer to the merchandise or does it refer to the ona'ah? But they take it very literally, that there's ein ona'ah the prutot is when it's worth a pruta. So you have all those different permutations. But that machloket that we saw between Levi and Rav Kahana yesterday, over here the Gemara is suggesting that the derivation from our Mishnah that told us that if you sell shtarot to a perfume bottler, that sale has ona'ah associated with it, which would be a minimal amount that you're selling the shtarot for, because you're not selling them for their written value, but rather for their inherent value or junk value almost. So there would be a statement that there is ona'ah the prutot, and it comes to undermine or to oppose that position of Rav Kahana. So now, the other thing to take note of, which we're not discussing here, but it happens to be that when we say ein ona'ah lekarkaot, there is a machloka between Rashi and the Balei Tosafot all over Shas. But Rashi says ein ona'ah lekarkaot means literally ein ona'ah lekarkaot. Property is all about location, location, location. It's in the eyes of the beholder. And therefore, there's no real market price for karka. And so no matter how much you overcharge or undercharge, it's all valid. Whatever the market bears or what the individual is willing to pay, that is the fair value of the karka. The Balei Tosafot, based on the Yerushalmi, say that when we say ein ona'ah lekarkaot, there is a limit to that, and that's up to 50%. Meaning that you have a variation in price that is considered to be valid volatility in the price of the market price, which is up to 50%. So if you charge 50%, or it would seem if you overcharge by double, that would be ein ona'ah lekarkaot. If you exceed those levels, then there would be ona'ah lekarkaot. So according to the Balei Tosafot, there is an extreme by where there is ona'ah lekarkaot. So that is a machloket all over Shas between them about what it means ein ona'ah lekarkaot. Mar says, hekdeshot, what about hekdesh? Why is it that there's no ona'ah there? Amakra, achiv velo hekdesh. Because over there it says, v'chi timkru memkar lamitecha, o kano miyad amitecha,
Altonu ishet achiv.
So achiv is not hekdesh. And if that's the case, hekdesh is not subject to ona'ah.
Matkif la rabba bar marmel. Koheichad yichtiv yado mamashu.
Are you going to tell me that the way that you're interpreting this pasuk that says, kano miyad amitecha, and we interpret that to mean davar niknem miyad liyad, literally something that's handed from hand to hand, mitautelin. Why don't you just say the word yad means reshut? It went from the possession of one person to the possession of the other person, not literally hand to hand. Ela me'ata dichtiv, and I can bring you a pasuk that it says, v'ikach et kol artzo miyado. They conquered all of his land, and they took it from his hand. Hachanami dechol arabi adehu denokidla. You're telling me that Sichon is holding all of his land in his hand, and he's handing it over to Bnei Israel? No. Elamir shuto. They conquered it and took it away from his possession. So you see, the word yad is used in the Torah not just to mean literally hand to hand, but mean more generically from possession of. And if you did that here, you would get a different answer or a different view about what Ona applies to. Where it says, Achanami, why can't you say the same thing here? Mir shuto. Mar retorts and says, we don't take it literally. We don't take the word yad literally. V'atanya, we have a breita. Im hi matzei ti matzei biyado. When it comes to a gneva, if it's found in his possession, ein li ela yado. I only have it if it's literally in his hand. Gago chatzero v'karpifo. If it's found in his property, meaning that the way Rashi describes it over here, the animal came into his property, he locked it into his property. It came there by itself, but then he locks it in. Or that his property acts on his behalf to steal the item. Minayin, how do we know that that works? Talmud Omar, im hi matzei ti matzei mikol makom. You need a reboy for that. So you see here in this drasha that they're taking the word yad very literally. The first havamina is that only yad would be subject to gneva. Then through a reboy, we include other items that are derivatives of your property or that they come into your possession. So you see they're taking it very literally. Tama dichtiv rachmana imatzei timatzei. It's only because of the reboy. I would have thought that yado means literally yad. Vitu. And we have another bright, Tanya. Benatan biyada. When it comes to a get, it says in the Torah, you have to put it into her hand. In the other yada. How do I know that it's not just her hand when you hand her the get that it works? Gaga chatzirah v'karpifa. How do I know if you put it into her possession, into her property, that the property acquires on her behalf? Minayin, I don't know that works. Tamud omer v'natan. Mikol makom. So the fact that it doesn't say biyada titnenu, but rather natan biyada, from that we learn that it's more expansive than just her hand. Again, it's only because of the reboy of natan. Halav hochi. Had it not been for the reboy, then I would have assumed, or the default explanation of the word yad literally means yad. Ela kol yado yado mamashu. You must conclude that anytime the Torah uses the word yad, it means literally yad. Vishani otam, by the case of the conquering of the possession of the properties of the lekala meimar achi. There you just can't explain it. In the context there, it's impossible to explain it as yad. Ela bishuto, so you have to explain it in that way. Now, it's clear or pretty obvious that in the Torah, the majority of the time when the word yad is used, it literally means yad. The questioner must have thought that, see, I can bring you a proof that sometimes the word yad is not used to literally mean yad, but also to mean reshut. And he says, based on that, how do I know in these situations what's the right way to interpret it? Can you really come to a halachic conclusion to say that una only applies to mantalfalim if there's a fair explanation to say the word yad means reshut and not yad mamash? The answer is yes, because the overwhelming evidence or the default usage of the word in the Torah, yad, means literally yad. Since that is the default explanation, the burden of proof is actually in the other direction. You have to show me that it's being used as reshut and not yad, and therefore only in a context where it's absolutely necessary to explain it that way will we explain it that way. Otherwise, the default is that it's going to literally be a yad. Okay, now, by Rabbi Zeru, schirut yesh lo ona o ein lo ona. When it comes to rentals, is there a din of ona or is there no din of ona? Now, schirut over here, you could explain in one of two ways. You could be talking about renting of property, and the Gemara's question is schirut different than the sale of property? We said before in the Mishnah that the sale of property is not subject to onah. So the question now is schirut the equivalent of selling a property? If you rent out property, is there onah? That's one way to phrase it. The other way to phrase it is that, of course, renting a property has no onah, because selling a property has no onah. But rather, the schirut here is a more general question about schirut, about rentals. Do rentals or a rental income, is it subject to ona'a? Because over there, even if you do it metaltalin, it's not a permanent sale. And therefore, maybe it's not subject to ona'a. So you could phrase the question one of two ways. Memkar amar rachmana, the Torah says a sale, avalo schirut, but not rentals. Odilma lo shna, or maybe it makes no difference. Amalei Abaye Miktiv Memkar Leolam. Doesn't say that you sold it forever. It says Memkar Stamaktiv. It just says you sold it. V'hai Nami Biyomei Mechirahu. Schirut is the equivalent of a day sale. Meaning that this is a perspective in rental. You didn't have to say this. You could have said that rental is more like a leasehold in the property, meaning that you have utility rights or usage rights over here. And it's nothing like Memkar, it's nothing like a Mechira. The way that Abaye is phrasing it, he's saying that Schirut is really a temporary sale, not simply access or rights to the utility or the output of the property, but literally it's a sale temporarily. It's a sale with a return date or an ability to buy it back at a date. So now, Bayrov, Chitin v'zaran bekarka mahu. He has wheat kernels that he's planting in the ground. What is the din? Yesh lehem ona'a o en lehem ona'a? What's the din here? Do they have ona'a or not? The obvious question relates to the karka aspect. They're now in the ground. The ground is not subject to ona'a. What is the status of these kernels vis-a-vis the karka? Kaman d'shadyan b'kad adamyan is the equivalent of them sitting in a kli, and therefore they're yesh lehem ona'a. Oh, dilma batlino al gav ga'ara. Or do they become batel? They are now nullified or insignificant vis-a-vis the karka, and therefore they're deemed to be karka, and therefore there would be no ona'a. Hey, chidami. What exactly is the scenario here? Ilei medamar ihu shadai bashita, the purchaser, or whether it's the person who's sending a shliach, says, put down 6. Va'atu sadei v'amrei delo shadai ba'el ha-chamisha, you only put down 5 seeds. Meaning that whatever this quantity is per measured area, he says you gotta put 6 in every location, and he puts 5 in every location. V'amar rova, kol davar shebimidah, shemishkal u'biminyan, afilu pachot mikdei ona'a chuzer. Anything that is measured, weighed, or counted is subject to ona'a, even if it's less than a 6. By the mere fact that you are measuring with such exactitude means that you're makpid in that exactitude. And therefore it's subject to ona'a no matter how much you've deviated. So over here, if he asked him for 6 seeds to be planted per square area, and he only planted 5, then he deviated from an exact request. And as Rashi notes over here, it's a mekach ta'ot. Forget about ona'a over here. This is a failure in the underlying sale because he deviated from what he had promised to do for him. Hachamashmo, the Rova Mairi Afri Karkot. Tosfot says over here that Rova's din, the way the Gemara is applying it, seems to apply even to Karkot, not simply to Metaltalin. And so Tosfot over here plays around with whether that's really true, because we see in other places that is not the case. And he quotes the Rashbam, who in other places says that the din of Rova does not apply to Karka. And he says over here, our Gemara seems to indicate that it does apply to Karka. And Tosfot comes up a way to differentiate between the cases, to say that that case where the Rashbam is speaking is not an exact measurement, but rather a more generic statement about it, but not giving exactitude to the measure. Whereas here, where Rava talks about exactitude of measure, it would even apply to Karka. Because the fact that you are basing it on an exact measurement makes it that there is a mekach ta'ut when you do not comply or you're not doing exactly what you promised that you were going to give. And the fact that we're measuring it in such exactitude means that people are makpid on it, and therefore there is ona'a. Ela damar idu shadi ba kidei ba'ila. He told them, put down what it needs. Viglai milta de lo shada ba kidei ba'ila. And then in the end, we realized that he didn't put down enough to make it like it needed. So in this case, he tells them, now, there are one of two ways to explain this Gemara. Either he's buying property from him and he's selling him property. He says, I've seeded it properly. I seeded it where it should be seeded. In the end, the guy buys it and then they realize that he didn't. That there's not enough produce coming out of here and he underseeded it. Or the situation is that they're sending a shliach to do the work. And he sends the worker to go put it down. And he says, put in what it needs. In the end, they come back and we see that there's not enough there. So did he abrogate his shlichut or did he fail to do what he was asked to do? Yesh lehem ona'a, o ein lehem ona'a. Over here is the ona'a. Keman d'shadi b'kado damyon. It's as if these seeds are in a bucket. They're in some sort of utensil. Yesh lehem ona'a, and they're subject to ona'a. So you either oversold the property, saying that it was planted properly. You charged more for the property now. Turns out it wasn't planted properly. So the market price for the property would have been less. And you overcharged for the property based on the fact that you claimed that you overplanted it. Or If you are asking a shliach to work on your behalf, you're paying him for the work that he did based on a certain output or doing it properly. He did it improperly, so you're overpaying him for the work. So is it subject to onah because he's a metalton? Odilma, batlinu agavaro. Or do we say that they are batel, they are insignificant vis-a-vis the karka, and karka doesn't have a din of onah? And if you claim here, why isn't this considered to be a mekach ta'ut? It's because he agrees to what he said was placed there, and he says that's what it needed. So his claim is that I did what it needed, and there's a disagreement about what it needed. So then, why isn't that considered to be onat karka oat? Because it changes the value of the karka. So the Balei Tosafot say that it's clear here that the wheat itself is what's contributing to the differential in price. It's not the karka, but rather how much that was planted, how much that is produced that is giving the onat the karka here. Nishba'in aleim? Oein nishba'im aleim? In the same vein, you can ask the same question with regards to a shvuah. We said there's no shvuah, the gabe karka. There is a shvuah when it comes to metaltalin. So, by a shvuah, command the shajin bekada damyan, are they the equivalent of being placed in a utensil, and therefore they are subject to a shvuah, nishbaim aleim? Or maybe they have the same status as karka, and therefore you would not take a shvuah on them. And the way Rashi explains it over here, that it's a case of moder b'miksat. He said 6, he said 5, and the guy admits to 5.5. I mean, you can come up with scenarios could generate a shvuata dayanim, where there's a disagreement about what happened here, and the defendant admits to a portion of the problem. And so there is, the question is it subject to shvua or not? Omer matiran, or ain't Omer matiran? When you bring the korbana Omer, does that now free these seeds of being chadash? Or do they need to wait for the following Omer? Now the Gemara asks about this. Hey, chidami, what is the scenario here? Ida ashush. Omer has nothing to do with whether they're planted or not planted in the ground. There's one qualification there is, did they root or did they not root before the Omer? If they've rooted in the ground before the Omer, then the Omer is matir them and they're no longer chadash. If they rooted after the Omer, they have to wait to the subsequent Omer and they remain chadash. Hey, chidami, ida ashush tanina. If they already rooted, that's a mishnah. Idolo ashush tanina. If they didn't root, that's also a mishnah. That's not. Imi shrishu kodem leomer. If they rooted before the omer, omer matiran. The omer takes them from being chadash to being yashan. Vim lav. If not, if they didn't root in time, then you have to wait till the subsequent omer, because then they would have rooted before the next omer, and it'll be chadash until the next omer. Lo tzricha. De chatzdinu. He already harvested them before the omer. So clearly, this Omer would change these kernels from being chadash into yashan because they were harvested. But before the Omer comes, Zarinu, he replants them, called them Omer, before they get to the Omer. Ba'atale Omer v'chalifi lavayu. Now the Omer passes by them. V'lo ishush, called them the Omer. And they did not yet root in the ground. Certainly, if they rooted before the Omer, then there's nothing to ask, because then not only are the seeds not chadash anymore, but their rooting makes it that the Omer covers them. And that's true here. The shift from being kernels to being seeds happens once it roots. Once it roots in the ground, there's no question that the item becomes chadash again, because otherwise you never have chadash. Because anytime you took out seeds and they became yoshan, and then you planted them, then they wouldn't become chadash again. So it's clear if it grows, then that it becomes chadash again and needs to go through an omer. The problem here is that it didn't grow yet. And so now it's sitting in the ground, waiting to root, but it was picked before this Omer. Did the Omer help it in the ground or not help in the ground? Mau, the minka to mechal minayu. Can you go and then pick them up out of the ground, the seeds that are there, and eat them? Come on, the shajim bikada damya. Is it like sitting in a utensil in the ground, and therefore you're taking them out of a utensil, and the Omer helped them, the shar inu Omer. The Omer therefore helped them because it's chadash that's not planted. And chadash that's not planted, the Omer makes into yashan. Or maybe they are now already in the ground and they are now defined as being already planted and you can no longer have them shift from chadash to yashan. They'll have to wait till the subsequent omer once they root. Teku. We leave all of these as unresolved issues as to what the status of these seeds that are sitting in the ground is. Okay, we're gonna stop here. 3 lines down on the top of Nun Zayin Amud Aleph.